Next up, Rose Kachadorian. She's the Pesticide Registration and Certification Leader for the Oregon Department of Ag. And thank you very much. Come on up.
This works. Are they going to turn it on? Ah, okay.
I don't know how it works. But
okay, I'll pray. Yeah, so I'm Rose Kachadorian with the Oregon Department of Ag. I've been with the department for about 20 years, and for a good portion of that, I reviewed special local need pesticide registration requests, the SLNs, the 24Cs, and probably for the first couple of years of my life at ODA, I was totally absorbed with grass grown for seed, so it's kind of near and dear to my heart. I'm going to be talking about a couple of different things today. Probably none of them will be popular with you, but I tend to be the one who brings the federal news to you. I'm going to be just briefly talking about a new certification and training rule, some on worker protection standards. You've probably been hearing a lot. I'm going to just bring up the things that are causing some concerns for people rather than give you a whole list of what you're supposed to do. I'm going to talk a little bit about the biological opinions. I've been talking about that since probably 2001. And also some pollinator language. I was asked to talk about that since a lot of grass seed growers are growing other crops, and including clover grown for seed. So just a little bit about the worker protection standard. I'm going to talk a little bit about the certification and training. So this new rule came out yesterday. It's 408 pages long, and I have not read the whole thing. And then today I received a 17-page synopsis, and I had a meeting all morning, so I just kind of went through that. And basically, three things I picked out of the synopsis, and I'm sure there's a lot more. I've been told there are things buried throughout this document that will impact certified applicators and certainly our agency. But there's going to be a big emphasis on the private applicators who are supervising the non-certified applicators. So if you are a licensed applicator and you're certifying a group of workers, or that we call them handlers, actually, that are putting zinc phosphide down the hole, we're going to have to test you on that now and to make sure you understand what your responsibilities are. We're also going to be having categories for private applicators. This is something that we normally only have for commercial applicators, but it's only going to be for aerial, which we already have because of the legislature, and fumigation. So if you're not flying an airplane or performing fumigation activities, you won't have a category for your private applicator's license. Also, we're required to verify that people who are signing those sheets are who they are. And that's actually something we already do. We have office staff that compares your signature, so when you sign that, with the signature that we have on file. And I'm sure there'll be a whole lot more in that rule. So I'm going to go on to WPS, because I do not want to keep you after 4. I have till 4, but I appreciate you staying. So basically, worker protection standard is a law. It's a federal law that Oregon OSHA is adopting. They adopted the old law, and now they're going to be adopting this new one with a few changes. And it's basically geared towards agricultural establishments in the production of agricultural plants. There's a lot of confusion. People think, well, a right-of-way person might be involved. I was contacted by the dairy farmers. They thought that somehow the pesticides, the disinfectants that they use in the dairy barns were going to be covered under WPS. That's not true. There are some weird things, though, with like even those big box stores, if they're using pesticides to maintain the plants, they're actually going to be covered under WPS. I don't think they know that yet, though. We'll have to break the news to them. It also requires that a person who's applying equipment wear certain personal protection equipment, and that measures need to be taken to protect workers and pesticide handlers. So if you're wondering, like, is the pesticide I'm using, is this something that's covered under WPS, just look for that agriculture use box on your pesticide label. And if you have that box, then that use is covered by WPS, and you take a look to see what that restricted entry interval, the REI, is. And if you have any workers, even somebody going into your field to move irrigation equipment, do anything, and it's within 30 days of the expiration of that REI, then you have to go through a lot of different training for that particular worker. So there are some exceptions. So if somebody is a certified applicator, if you're a licensed applicator, then you do not need to go through the WPS training. It's kind of interesting that consultants are not considered certified applicators. And so for consultants, we're recommending for them to get a private applicator's license. They can do that without taking a test. They just have to apply for that license. Apprentices and trainees are also not certified applicators. Also, if you have a worker who has been trained as a handler, then they're also exempt from training. And if somebody is a crop advisor, and we're right now looking to see if EPA's definition of a crop advisor is the same as what we are considering a consultant. So probably the most controversial part of WPS is something that they didn't even have in their proposed rule. So it kind of blindsided the states and certainly the regulated community, and this was the application exclusion zone. And this is this halo that follows the application equipment. And depending on what kind of equipment you're using, that depends on the size of that halo. And people can't be in that halo. So if you're using a boom sprayer, then that's a 25-foot halo. If you're using an air blast sprayer, that's a 100-foot halo. I started thinking when I saw Kevin Masterson's photograph of that hazelnut orchard, and you had the grapes and you had the road. He was talking about the ditch and the drift onto the other crop, and I'm thinking, wow, how about if a bicyclist went by or a car? Where are we at with that whole thing? Lately, I've been contacted by people. One was a nurseryman who had purposely planted a bunch of tall conifers around his nursery, and I've seen this with grass seed. I was just on 99 the other day going down to Eugene, and you'll see somebody who has purposely planted conifers, or you'll talk to somebody who's growing grass seed or some other crop next to a bike trail. And they say, well, we can't even see. How are we supposed to follow this 100-foot application exclusion zone? So this isn't even drift. That nobody is supposed to be in there. So we thought, you know, that is a problem. How are we going to deal with this situation, you know, especially for people who have purposely planted things there so there's not drift? And so we contacted EPA. And we said, we need something practical. Just to say that nobody can ever be in there is just not very workable. And so what they said is that if you have reason to believe that somebody is in that area, then you're supposed to suspend your application and then take a look, make sure no one is around, and then proceed. And then there was also the recommendation that if you are farming next to a road or a bike trail or someplace like that, just to take some precautions as far as, You know, don't spray on a Saturday afternoon of a holiday weekend type of thing. Try to figure out like when people will not be on the road, the school bus isn't going by, somebody's not on the bike trail, and make your application then. And also to be really aware of where the wind is going. So you can say, you know, nobody was in that AEZ. So this is a little bit beyond that whole concept of drift. I think this probably came about because someplace, probably California actually, where you had two different farmers. One person had workers in his field, maybe picking tomatoes or something, strawberries, and somebody else in the next field making an application, and their drift occurred. And so now we have basically a new law that is being enforced by Oregon OSHA and ODA. Another big thing with WPS is where you would only have to train your workers before once every 5 years, the workers and handlers, and now it's every year. There also used to be a grace period. And now there's no grace period, that you have to train the individuals before they get into the field. This also includes the use of vertebrate control products like zinc phosphide. I'm probably very familiar with zinc phosphide, and granted all those SLNs, but for a while, even EPA did not put any worker protection standard information on the zinc phosphide labels or any of those rodenticide labels. But now it has come to their attention that it's actually in the law that it is covered under WPS. And so if you are having workers come to your fields and placing the zinc phosphide down the hole, there's a whole bunch of more training requirements that are involved. So another area of controversy is there are new record-keeping requirements. Before, there was just central posting requirements, but now you're required to keep records for a two-year period, and this is for not only restricted-use pesticides, but general-use pesticides, and there's a whole list of things. Of course, the pesticide name, the EPA reg number, the active ingredient, the crop, the location of that crop, the time that that application started and ended, the date, that duration of that restricted entry interval. For example, I showed you the one that was for 12 hours, and also a copy of the safety data sheet. So now we're on to the last, I don't want to say the last controversial area, but designated representative. What is that? This caused a lot of concern because there were farmers that thought that anybody could just come to their property and demand to see their application records. This is not the case, but there is some concern that people have. Basically, if you have an individual that, for whatever reason, feels that they don't want to go to their former employer or their current employer and ask for a copy of the records, let's say they're feeling sick or they have some kind of concern, that they can actually designate somebody else to come to your farm and ask for those records, and that you have to provide those records within 15 days at a nominal cost. And so what that person has to provide is they have to provide the name of the worker that they're representing. They have to give very specific information as far as like when was that person employed, what are the dates the records are being requested, what was that person doing, were they harvesting, were they making applications, and just the specific application information. They also have to provide a letter stating that the farm worker that they're representing is in agreement with all this. So somebody can't say, well, you know what, I'm gonna go help these people and I'm gonna go ask for those records. No, there actually has to be something in writing that this person wants that other person to represent them. And that's in writing, and there's an actual signature. And then they also have to provide information as far as where this information can be sent. We're hoping to have all this information on our website. If for some reason, I mean, we don't anticipate that there will be any abuse of this, but if for some reason, you know, somebody feels that this is being abused, you know, certainly we want the law to be followed, not to be abused. So you could certainly give us a call. Also, we're going to be doing some joint trainings. We actually started with Oregon OSHA and OSU. The Oregon Department of Agriculture has funded a WPS trainings for something called Train the Trainer. And we're holding 8 different trainings. One of them has already been held. They're filling up very quickly. One of the reasons that they're filling up very quickly is the federal law states that if you're a certified applicator, a licensed applicator, that you are able to train any kind of handlers. The Oregon OSHA is actually kind of upping that standard. And they're saying if you're going to be training a pesticide handler, one of your, you know, hired people to make pesticide applications, whether they're restricted use or general use, that it's no longer sufficient that you have that you're a certified applicator, that you have to go through one of these train the trainer programs. So this is a kind of a controversial area. I know that Farm Bureau and Oregonians for Food and Shelter and others are sending out emails asking people to comment. That comment period closes tomorrow. So I'm not suggesting for you to comment on this, but if that is something that you're interested in doing, tomorrow is the deadline. All right, so now I'm going to move on to another topic. I'm going to try to get you out of here on time. So this is, biological evaluations. So I'm not going to go through the whole history because that would take an hour to go through all of the different lawsuits that have gone on. I don't know if you remember that at that one point that for Lorazepam chlorpyrifos, NIMS was saying that it needed a 500-foot buffer. Then that was vacated, basically thrown out by the court. So what has happened is that EPA and this what we call the services, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, NIMS, have all gotten together with the National Academy of Sciences and figured out a way to do this where everybody thinks it's a legitimate process. And so EPA had released a draft, what they call a biological evaluation. They received about 78,000 comments on that. A lot of them were mass market, but some of them were kind of unique. We were expecting the final biological evaluation out of EPA this December, but it's being postponed until January of next year. And then what's going to happen is that the services, NIMS, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, and that will look at that biological evaluation and develop a biological opinion. They'll put that biological opinion out for public comment. That is something you really should take a look at because if you recall before, that is where those mitigation measures were, those methods of reducing risk are listed. So those are possibly things that can go on the pesticide label. So that's where we saw the 500-foot buffers, the 1,000-foot buffers were on those. And then we're going to see a final biological opinion in December 2017. So, and we'll kind of keep you informed and certainly work with Steve Salisbury and others on that. We're also going to be seeing biological opinions for the carbamates, methamyl, like lanate, and carbaryl, which is 7. So we'll be seeing those this upcoming spring, the draft for that, and then we'll see the biological opinion in December 2018. And again, with all of these biological opinions, we expect additional restrictions that will go along with them. The interesting thing is that you know, in the past, it was always just the Northwest, and it was all about salmon. Well, now these are all national, and they're looking at many, many different endangered species. So these restrictions will be nationwide, not just affecting us. I don't know if Steve Salisbury mentioned the situation with chlorpyrifos. So in November 10th, we received a kind of a pre-publication version of assessment by EPA. And in that assessment, they said that that the residues that were to be expected on food crops for chlorpyrifos that were pretty much unacceptable, and that they kind of supported the revocation of all of the tolerances, and also the drinking water issue was also not working out very well. And so then they had another federal register notice on November 17th. And in there, they said something kind of interesting. It was almost like there was a plea for the registrant or somebody to say, which uses should we get rid of to maintain other ones? Because historically this has happened. If you remember with diazinon, there were a lot of uses, and then we saw a lot of uses go away, and then that material was maintained. Because with the models that EPA uses, they finally kind of got that risk level low enough. But for some reason, that's not happening with chlorpyrifos. And so I hope that we're not going to be in this situation where, because, you know, somebody, and I don't know who's kind of putting their heels in the ground, if that's going on, that they're not willing to budge on some of the uses. So we're going to see what will happen with that. And, you know, I know that the material has a lot of value. I know people have concerns about it, but there still is a lot of value for it. So a little bit about pollinators. I'll try to cover this in like 5 minutes, 5 or 10 minutes. And so EPA is still working on restrictive label language for pollinators. They're not really focused right now on the systemic issues. This is where the insecticide goes to the pollen and nectar. This is something that is problematic. And they are kind of focusing more on what we call RT25 values. This is like the residual toxicity. So at what point, what length of time is it where you're only having 25% of the bees dying? So in this case, a long RT value is a bad RT value. So that means it really is going to last a long time before it stops killing a lot of bees. So if you look at some of the chemicals that are used a lot, we look at chlorpyrifos at 16 to 24 hours, that RT value, you get to something like spinosad, and you're talking only 3 hours. So that looks pretty good. Some of the proposals, and this is just really very tentative, is they're saying kind of on the base level label, if you have any flowers, you can't apply any insecticides. Then there's one thought, well, if you're using something with a low RT value, you can possibly apply in the late evening. Then there's another thought, train of thought, that if you have a crop with an indeterminate bloom, that basically allowing, again, those late evening applications, or early evening, I should say, early evening applications, and maybe if it's, you know, like 50 degrees outside, if you have it cool, that you can apply. And I think some of this, especially with this indeterminate crop, is that, you know, we told them, well, what about clover grown for seed? You know, that's going to be blooming a long time. We have crops here that are blooming a long time, especially with our seed crops. And I know that this is, you know, you guys are mostly growing grass grown for seed, but I suspect that some of you are growing something that's blooming also. So I've been talking about a pollinator plan for a while. This is something that was coming at the federal level, but then it also came to us from the Oregon legislature. And so the Oregon legislature indicated that Oregon State University, in consultation with ODA, should develop a pollinator health outreach and education plans, let's say, for avoiding adverse effects of pesticides on bees, and that we should develop a pesticide use safety plan. And also indicated that the pesticide registration dollars that are paid by the pesticide registrants, that $10 of that should go to OSU. So currently we're giving $120,000 to Oregon State University to do this. We're still heavily engaged at the national level. We're working with Oregon State to develop stakeholder groups, not only stakeholder groups for people who are growing plants that are flowering, but if you can think about like even grass seed growers, let's say somebody next door, a blueberry grower, has a bunch of hives out. He has a beekeeper who's contracted with, and let's say a grass seed grower needs to make an insecticide application, that we want to be able to have that grass seed grower or whoever that is, a weed grower, to think, wow, you know, the wind is blowing towards those beehives, and even though I'm not growing a flowering crop, I'm going to like start thinking about the whole system and whether there are bees around. And so something like that would be included in the pollinator plan. We're also working with OSU to develop some educational materials. And we also want to work more with the pesticide registrants to get some more of that RT25 data. So growers can make their own decisions. So growers can take a look at what those figures are. And if they're thinking, well, you know, I'm going to be having bees come in, or my neighbor's going to be having bees come in, and I know there's something in my crop that for some reason they might be coming over here, it would just allow you to have a lot more decision making. So that's all I'm going to talk about, because I know you guys are so good. It's 4 o'clock now, and I appreciate you being here. Do you have any questions? I know I went through that fast, you know, WPS, chlorpyrifos, biological opinions, and pollinator plan. Anything? Well, I understand how it is at the end of a conference, so thank you very much.